Namaskaram. Today I'm going to be talking about the third verse of Aplapattu. And just as a reminder, this song is a kirtanam. That means that it begins with a pallavi. Pallavi means more or less the same as a refrain, followed by an anupallavi, followed by a number of verses. But Anupallavi and the verses are all connected with the Pallavi. In fact, in this case, none of the verses are a complete sentence. They are all, each of the verses is an extended adverbial clause that connects with the Pallavi. So the sense of every verse is completed by the Pallavi. And the Pallavi is, the Pallavi consists of two sentences. Aplam itu paru, that means making Aplam, see. And the second sentence is, ade sapitu un ase etiru, eating it, put an end to your desire. So, as I say, each of the verses is an adverbial clause. So it connects with the first sentence of this Pallavi, making Aplam, see. Making Aplam is also an adverbial clause. The main verb is see. The Aplam that Bhagavan is talking about here is what he describes in the final verse as the Tanmaya Aplam, the Aplam that is composed of oneself, composed of Tat, of Brahman. In other words, our own real nature. So making Aplam see implies see what you really are. So the whole aim of this song, that's what Bhagavan is describing in each of these verses, is how we can see what we actually are. And by seeing what we actually are, we thereby put an end to all our desire, because desire arises only for ego. Only when we limit ourselves by rising as ego do there seem to be things other than ourselves. So, and consequently, we desire both things that will contribute, which we believe will contribute to our happiness, and we have aversion for both things that will detract from our happiness. So desire and aversion and all arise only because we've risen as ego. And we've risen as ego, that is, ego itself is self-ignorance. That is, we can't say because we are self-ignorant, we've risen as ego, because what is self-ignorant? It's only ego, but the very nature of ego is to be self-ignorant. So we can put an end to ego only by seeing what we actually are. So that is what this song is all about. In the first verse, Bhagavan described the main ingredient. The main ingredient in making an apalam is black gram grains. Those black gram grains, the first thing to be done is to break and pulverize them in a handmill. So that's what the first verse is describing, that process of breaking the black gram grains in the breaking and pulverizing the black gram grains in a handmill. But black gram grains, he describes as the manam, the abhimanam, the identification but a body is oneself. He said the manam that grows in the field of five sheaves. The field of five sheaves means the body, which consists of five sheaves, namely the physical form of the body, the prana or life, manas or mind, the buddhi or intellect, and the chittam or will. Which are respectively called anamaya kosha, pranamaya kosha, manamaya kosha, vijnanamaya kosha, and anandamaya kosha. These five sheaves make up the person that we seem to be. So this is what Bhagavan generally refers to as body. And what grows in this body is this attachment, this identification, namely ego. That as ego, we're always aware of ourselves as I am this body. So without grasping a body as itself, ego cannot rise, stand, or flourish. As he points out in verse 20, or he implies in verse 25 of Ulurunapadu. So in this field of five sheaves, this false identification, I am this body, arises. That is ego, and that is what he compares here to the black gram grains, and that has to be broken and pulverized in the handmill. The handmill he describes as jnana vichara. Jnana vichara means awareness, investigation, and he says the nana en jnana vichara. That is the awareness, investigation. Who am I? So this is the initial process, what he describes in verse 1. In verse 2, he then goes on to describe the other ingredients that have to be added that's once you've broken and pulverized the black gram, what you have to add to it is the juice of the square-stemmed vine, which he says is satsanga, the cumin and black pepper, which are sama and dhamma, and salt, which is uparati. These are some of the basic qualifications required for following any spiritual path, particularly this path of self-investigation. With that, you have to mix asafoetida, which is the good vasana in the heart. The good vasana in the heart, what he's referring to is the sat vasana, the inclination, a liking to turn within, to be self-attentive, in order to just be as we actually are, rather than rising as ego. So these additional ingredients are described in verse 2. And then in verse 3, he goes on to describe the next two processes. The next process in making an apalam is once you've pulverized the black gram, you've added the other ingredients, then you need to, they all need to be pounded in a mortar using a pestle. So this is what he's describing here. And then that he describes in the first two lines of this verse. Then after you've pounded that, the resulting dough then has to be rolled into thin wafers on a rolling board using a rolling pin. So that is what he describes in the second half of this verse. And finally, you have to fry the apalam and eat it. That's what he describes in the final verse, which we'll talk about next time. So what he's talking about in this verse, he's describing a metaphorical significance of these two processes of pounding the mixture and then rolling it into wafers. When making an apalam, because it's a physical process, obviously we have to go through stages. We need to the initial preparation, the additional ingredients, then pounding them together, then rolling them. These are all step-by-step process. In the practice of self-investigation, there's no such step-by-step process. That is, self-investigation is an extremely simple practice. It is just a matter of turning our attention inwards to face ourselves alone. So what he described in the first verse as breaking and pulverizing the black gram, namely ego, in the handmill, which is jnana vichara, who am I? That is the practice of self-investigation. He's describing the same practice in this verse, but he's using a different metaphor, but it's the same practice. We shouldn't think that, but he's meaning to describe different practices. It's the same practice, just described in a different way. So what he says in the first two lines of this verse is, Kal Nengel Nan Nan Endru Kalangamal Unmukha Ulankayal Oyadu Iditu. What that means is, by the pestle of facing inwards, without being agitated, incessantly pounding as I am I in the heart stone. So this is this one process. Then the next two lines, he describes the next process. So what does he mean here? The first words are Kal Nengel. Cullen Angel literally means in the stone heart. He's not saying that we need to be stone-hearted in order to practice self-investigation. Stone heart means the heart of a mind that is firm like a stone. That is, if you want to pound something in a mortar, the mortar needs to be solid and firm, and then only your pounding will have effect. If you put the ingredients on a soft cushion and try pounding them, obviously you're not going to get any results. You need to have a firm base in which to do it. That firm base that is required for self-investigation is what is often described as titiksha. That's for forbearance. We need to be very firm and steady, unshakable. Whatever troubles life may throw at us, we shouldn't be diverted away from our determination to be inward facing, to be self-attentive, to hold on to self-attentiveness requires great patience and perseverance, because the natural flow of the mind, of the attention, is to be going outwards towards other things. So in order to hold firmly onto self-attentiveness without being shaken, we need firm forbearance, firm patience. So that's what is implied by this firm stone. So the stone heart means the heart that is, or the mind that is as firm as a stone, that is so dedicated and having so much endurance, patience, and forbearance. But come what may, I will not be shaken from my self-attentiveness. That is what is the implication of this term, Cullen Angel, in the stone heart, that's in the heart that is as firm as a stone. So the first word, as I say, first word is Cullen Angel. Then, I won't do it in exactly the same order, because what are we to do in that Cullen Angel? We have to pound the ingredients. We have to oyadu iditu, means incessantly, incessantly pounding. So what is the instrument with which we pound? It is a pestle. The pestle in this case, he describes, the word for pestle that he uses here is ulakai. Ulakai means a pestle. But what type of ulakai is it? Unmukha ulakai. Unmukha means is a compound of two words, ul, which means inside, and mukha means facing. Mukha is a Sanskrit word, ul is a Tamil word. So unmukha means facing inwards. Bhagavan often described this practice of self-investigation as facing inwards, but we need to understand what is meant by this. That is, inward, inside and outside, or inward and outward, these are relative terms. So what is inside from one perspective may be outside from another perspective. So for example, all the organs of the body, they are inside the body. But the whole body is an object perceived by us. So the body is something outside of us. So though the organs, relative to the body, the organs are inside. Relative to us, they're something outside. Likewise, the mind and all its thoughts, all the thoughts seem to be inside the mind, but they are external to ourselves. That is, they're something other than ourselves, because we see all the thoughts and feelings and emotions and perceptions and memories and everything that arises, and the likes and the dislikes and everything that arise in the mind. Though they seem to be in the mind, they are external to us in the sense that they are something other than ourselves. So in the context of self-investigation, when Bhagavan talks about facing inwards, what he means by inwards, it means everything other than ourselves is outside. So inside is only ourself. So facing inwards means facing ourself alone, not allowing our attention to move away from ourself towards anything else. Because in some spiritual paths, for example, in yoga, what they take to be introversion, they're meditating in their mind on some image or some whatever it may be, on some chakra, maybe some chakra in the body or the kundalini or something. The chakras and kundalini, they're inside relative to the body, but they're still outside relative to us. Likewise, any image that we may have in our mind of any deity or anything, it may be inside the mind, but it's outside us. So though in some spiritual paths, looking inside means looking inside the body or looking inside the mind, what Bhagavan means when he says looking inside, it's something, or facing inside, he's using inside in a much deeper sense. Looking inside means looking only at ourselves, facing only towards ourselves. The usual Sanskrit term for facing inwards is antamukham. And unmukham means the same. It means facing inwards. But another term that Bhagavan often used in Tamil is ahamukham. And ahamukham has a double meaning in Tamil, because aham, there are two words, aham. One, there's a native Tamil word, the word that belongs to Tamil itself, aham, which means inside. And therefore, by extension, it means the heart. It means also means a home. Aham in the Tamil word aham means inside. There's also the Sanskrit first person pronoun aham, which means I, which is also very often used in Tamil spiritual literature. So when Bhagavan talks about ahamukham, we can take it to mean facing inside or facing towards I. Actually, Bhagavan deliberately used this word with this double meaning to make it clear. But what is facing inwards? It's facing only I. So facing anything other than I is facing outwards. Even if it seems to be, this is a thought in my mind. I'm meditating on the thought of Shiva or Rama or Krishna or whatever God it is, or I'm meditating on a mantra inside my mind. That is all bahyamukham. That's all facing outwards in the sense in which Bhagavan is using it here. So when he talks about facing inwards in the context of self-investigation, he means attending only to I, not facing anything other than ourself. So what he describes here as the pestle of facing inwards is exactly the same that he described in the first verse as the handmill of jnana vichara. That both are metaphors metaphors used to describe the practice of being self-attentive, being inward facing, being self facing inwards, facing selfwards, facing towards ourself alone. So the means by which we pound these ingredients, the ingredients being the dehabhimana or ego, identification, I am this body, and all the other ingredients, they need to be well pounded together before they can be, because the powder needs to be very fine before you can make a smooth dough out of it. So he uses various adverbs here. He says, oyadu idutu. Oyadu means incessantly, that is constantly pounding these. That implies that we may not be able to hold on to self-attentive incessantly, but our aim should be to hold on to it incessantly. So we should be moving towards that, our self-attentiveness should become more and more steady, more and more we need to avoid interruptions, avoid letting go of the self-attentiveness. That is what we should be aiming for. That is the implication of Oyadu. He also says Kalangamal. Kalangamal means without being agitated or without being confused. What that implies is without allowing our attention to be moved away from ourselves. That is, as soon as our attention moves away from itself, that is an agitation. It's a movement of so long as we're facing inwards, the mind is quiet, in a state of quietness and equanimity, because being self-attentive is not an action. It is a being. But that is, by attending to anything other than ourselves, that is an action, because it's a movement of our mind away from ourselves, a movement of our attention away from ourselves towards something else. Whereas being self-attentive, we are not moving anywhere. We are just being as we actually are. So allowing our attention to move away from ourselves is an agitation of the equanimity of the mind. It is also results in confusion. Kalangama means both without being agitated, and it can also be taken to mean without being confused. So the basic meaning of without being agitated is without allowing our attention to be disturbed by moving away towards anything else. And then the other adverbial clause within this clause is nan nan endru, which means as I am I. This has a very, that is, this term nan nan or aham aham, these are terms that Bhagavan often uses both to describe the practice and to describe the goal. That is, now when we rise as ego, we are aware of ourselves as I am this body. The more we look within, the more our identification, which was previously latching onto a body and taking this body as I, we begin to recognize more and more clearly that what we actually are is not this body or anything else. What we actually are is only I am I. That means I am nothing other than I. That is, so the term aham, nan nan or aham aham implies the recognition of ourself as ourself alone, recognizing that we are nothing other than ourself. We are not this or that, we are just I. The more we look within, the more clearly we will become aware that what we actually are is nothing but this fundamental awareness I am, nothing but this basic awareness of our own existence. So long as we are looking outwards, we seem to be a body. Whenever we're aware of anything other than ourselves, we're aware of ourselves as I am this body. But the more we look within, the more that identification with the body begins to lose its hold, and it becomes more and more clear to us that what we actually are is just that simple awareness I am. So this recognition, this clarity of self-awareness that we gain by looking within is what Bhagavan often referred to as Spurana. Spurana is a noun derived from a Sanskrit verb spur. Spur means to shine, or depending on the context. In some context, it means to palpitate or to vibrate or anything. But the basic meaning of spur is something that makes itself clear, that makes itself known. But the sense in which Bhagavan is using it, that is, in some English books you'll find it translated as vibration or palpitation or something, the palpitation of I, that is not what Bhagavan means. It is the sense in which he uses the word spur is in the sense of clarity. So it's something shines clearly, it's clearly known because of its clear shining. So it's that clarity of self-awareness is what Bhagavan refers to as spurana or aham spurana. So Smarana means the shining, or the shining forth, or the making itself known. So that it's referring to that. We are always aware of ourselves. We're always aware I am. But so long as we're looking outwards, we're not aware of ourselves as we actually are. The more we look within, the more clearly we will become aware of ourselves as ourself alone, as I am just I, nothing other than I. So that clarity of self-awareness, that Bhagavan refers to as I am I, is what he also describes as Smarana. So Smarana means that fresh clarity of awareness. And we experience that fresh clarity of awareness to the extent to which we look within. So Smarana is not an experience as such. It's a quality of experience. That is, we are all, but our basic experience is always I am. But so long as we're looking outwards, we are, though we're aware I am, we know that we are, we don't know what we are. So we know that I am, but not what I am. So the more we look within, the more it becomes clear to us that what I am is only I and nothing other than I. So that clarity that we gain to the extent to which we look within. So as soon as we turn our attention back to ourselves, we begin to experience Smarana. But the more deeply we look within, the more clearly the Smarana shines. And eventually, that clarity will swallow us. We will lose ourselves in that clarity, because what that Smarana ultimately is nothing but the pure awareness that we actually are. In some places, Bhagavan talks about the subsidence of Smarana. So we need to understand what he means by this. For example, in Vichara Sangraham, he uses the analogy of a flame that catches camphor. If a flame catches camphor, it will continue burning until all the camphor is consumed. Once the camphor is consumed, the fire is also extinguished, because there's no fuel left for it to burn. So since Smarana means clarity of self-awareness, does that mean that as soon as the camphor in that analogy is ego, the false awareness, I am this body. So does Bhagavan mean then that when this clarity of self-awareness destroys ego, then the clarity of self-awareness will go away, it will be extinguished, it will subside? No, that is not what he means. Because Smarana, though it means clarity of awareness, it means in particular that fresh clarity of awareness. That is, we are always clearly aware, I am. But so long as we're looking outwards, that I am is mixed and conflated with adjuncts, as I am this body. The more we look within, the more we experience that clarity of self-awareness as a fresh and new clarity, that the more we become aware of ourselves as nothing other than I, but that's a new and clear experience. And eventually, when we look within so keenly that we thereby cease to be aware of anything else, ego is thereby destroyed. And the destruction of ego and the full clarity of Smarana are simultaneously. That is, as soon as we attend to ourselves so keenly, but we see ourselves as we actually are, that is the full clarity of self-awareness, that will destroy ego. What will then subside is not the clarity of self-awareness, but the newness of it. That is, so long as we are, because we are now used to being aware of ourselves as I am this body, the more we look within and become aware of ourselves as I am just I, that's something new, something fresh. So we feel the more we look within, the more clear and obvious this fundamental awareness I am becomes to us. And the more clear it becomes to us that we are nothing other than that. So long as ego survives, this seems to be something new and fresh. And the deeper we go within, the more newer and fresher it seems to be. And eventually when ego is destroyed, it shines with all its newness and freshness. Just like if the sun is always shining in the sky, but if it's a cloudy day, we can't see the sun directly. The sunlight is filtered through the cloud, so we're not seeing the sun as it is. But if the winds come and blow away the clouds, the sun seems to appear afresh. Of course, it was always there, but we can see it clearly only when the clouds are removed. Likewise, when the cloud of ego is removed, we see ourselves with a fresh clarity. So that is what Bhagavan describes, for example, in so many places, in verse 2 of Anma Vidde, verse 20 of Upadesha Undia and Upadesha Saram, and in verse 30 of Uludunapadu, he says, when I dies, one thing will shine forth as I am I. So there he's referring to what he, in that case, the I am I is a full clarity of self-awareness. It's not just the partial clarity, but we experience during practice, a full clarity. So momentarily, that seems something new, because till then, ego was there obscuring that clarity of self-awareness. When ego is destroyed, it seems to be something new and fresh. But Bhagavan says in verse 30 of Uludunapadu, though it appears, it is not I, meaning it is not ego, it is the Purna, it is the infinite whole, it is what we actually are. So when ego is swallowed by that clarity, momentarily it seems to be a perfectly fresh and new clarity, but then instantly we recognize this is not anything new. This is what I always am. I've never been anything other than this fundamental awareness I am. So what momentarily seems something new is the next moment is recognized, this is sahaja, this is natural, this is what I always am. So the state in which ego is destroyed, completely consumed, and thereby so long as the ego is there, it seems to be something new. When ego is destroyed, it shines with a fresh clarity, but that clarity is so great, but instantly we recognize this is not anything new. This is sahaja, this is natural. So that recognition, but what till now seemed to be a new and fresh clarity of self-awareness, asparana, when it is recognized to be our own real nature, sahaja, that is what Bhagavan described as the subsidence or cessation or extinguishing of sparana. That's what he means by that analogy of the camphor and the flame. When the camphor is consumed, the flame dies down. When ego is consumed by the infinite clarity of self-awareness, the infinite clarity of self-awareness ceases to be something new or fresh. It becomes what is eternal, natural, what is our own real nature. So that's a slight digression here, but why I'm saying this is Bhagavan used this term, nan nan, I am I, both to describe the practice, as in this case, and to describe the final attainment. According to Bhagavan, the ultimate truth is not I am this or I am that. Even I am Brahman is an imperfect way of expressing it. When we know ourselves as we actually are, there is nothing other than ourselves. So who am I? I am only I, nothing other than I. So Bhagavan uses this term, nan nan, I am I, both to describe the ultimate reality and to describe the clarity with which we experience that during practice. For example, in the verse Hridaya Guhara Madhye Kevalam Brahma Matram Hyam Aham Aham Iti Kuta Aham Aham Iti Sakshat Atma Rupena Bhati. That is Brahman itself. Brahman itself is always is that which always exists and shines in the heart as as oneself, as I am I. So I that aham aham or nan nan refers to our real nature, what we actually are. During practice, we are just beginning to recognize, but we are not this body or anything else. We are just that I. And the more we recognize that I am just I, the more love we develop to cling only to I. Because what am I? I'm nothing but I, nothing else. So that as the Sparana shines more and more brightly in our heart by our looking within, our love to look within grows stronger and stronger and stronger. Finally, we are swallowed by that clarity. Then we recognize that clarity is not something new. It is sahaja. It's our own real nature. So Bhagavan used the word sparana both to refer to the clarity, the partial clarity experienced by during practice, and to the full clarity that is experienced when we are finally completely lose ourselves in ourself, lose ourselves in what we actually are, lose ego in our real nature. But in this context, he's talking about the practice. So it's the practice of the more we look within, the more clearly we are aware of ourselves as I am I, the more clearly we recognize that we are nothing other than I. So that's what he means here by nan nan, by as I am I. That is, it is that recognition. At first, the recognition may be faint, but the more we look within, the more clear and bright and obvious that recognition of ourself as ourself alone will become. So what do we need to do? All we need to do is to look within more and more and more. So the key is unmukha, looking within, or facing within, or being self-attentive, attending to nothing other than ourself. The more we look within, the more brightly the sparana shines as I am I, until finally it shine. When we look within so keenly, but we thereby cease to be aware of anything else, we lose ourselves in that clarity of sparana, then the newness of that clarity subsides, and it is recognized as sahaja, our own real nature. So far I've talked about the first two lines of this verse. That is the pounding of the ingredients in the mortar. The mortar is the heart, which is imbued with firm titiksha, firm patience and forbearance, the ability to hold on to self-attentiveness, come what may. That's the firmness, the hardness that is required. And the pestle is the pestle of looking within to see ourselves as we actually are, to see ourselves as I am I. And that needs to be oyadu, unceasingly, and kalangama, without being agitated, without being disturbed or by allowing our attention to move away towards anything else. So this is what he describes in the first two lines. Then in the next two lines, that is the process of pounding the ingredient. Once the ingredients have been well pounded, they then need to be flattened and rolled on a firm board to make the aplam, the thin wafers, but are subsequently to be fried. First they're dried and then they're fried. But as I say, though in making an aplam, there are many different, it's a step-by-step process. You have to go through all the steps. In this practice of self-investigation, there is only one step, facing within, looking within to see who am I. So what he says in the next two lines are, in the last two lines, santamam kuravial, that means by the rolling peace, which is shantam, which is peace. Samamana palaheil, on the board, which is equanimity. Santatum, that means always. Salipuara, without weariness. Santosha Mahave, joyfully. Making aplam si. The making aplam si is not part of the verse, it's the Pallavi, but the verse connects with the Pallavi. So what he means by this, since he describes this, this comes immediately after describing the pounding being looking within, the implication, since the first word he uses is santum, peace, that is, to the extent to which we look within, what we will experience is peace. So the significance of this, of him describing the rolling pin as peace, is that the more we look within, the more we experience our real nature, which is perfect peace. And it, not only is it peace, it is a state of equanimity, summum. But in order to experience that peace and equanimity, we need to hold on to the self-attentiveness firmly. So he also says, without weariness. If we become weary in the process of self-investigation and allow our attention to drift outwards, then we lose the peace and equanimity, or we never lose them because they're our real nature, but we cease to be aware of ourself as that peace and equanimity that is ever shining in our heart as I am I. In order to go deep in this practice of self-investigation, we need to hold on to self-attentiveness so firmly that peace is firmly established in our heart. Because if you want to roll the aplam dough to make thin wafers, the board on which you roll it has to be very stable. So we need stability in our practice. And so by being stable in our practice, by holding on to self-attentiveness firmly, that peace settles in our heart. That peace is the stable board. So santam means peace, tranquility, composure, contentment, resignation, subsidence. These are what is brought about by our looking within, by our being self-attentive. And on this steady board of the tranquil, peaceful, subsided mind, we need to roll it using a rolling pin. Rolling pin, he describes as summum. Summum means sameness, constancy, evenness, equanimity, imperturbability, or it means samadhi in its deepest sense. That is, the deeper sense of samadhi is means the mind or intellect. Summum means the state of sameness or constancy. So that steady state in which the mind remains firmly established, firmly holding on to I am, that is the state of samadhi in its true sense, in its deepest sense. The term samadhi is a term that is used in a different sense, in different contexts. But in this sense, this is what samadhi means, the deeper sense of samadhi. It is just holding firmly onto self-attentiveness. That is the state of when the mind is in a state of equanimity, of sameness, of imperturbability, when it's steady. In Tamil, the word summum, that is there are fewer consonants in Tamil script than there are in Sanskrit. So sometimes Sanskrit words, two different Sanskrit words, are spelt the same in Tamil. So we need to understand from a context in which it's used. Some of them in Tamil can be a transliteration of two Sanskrit words, shama and summer. In the previous verse, he used the same word samam. There he was referring to shama. Shama means calmness, tranquility, equanimity, pacification or cessation of mind. Here he's using it in the sense of summer, which means sameness, constancy, evenness, equanimity, imperturbability. These are two entirely different words. There is a certain overlap in their meaning because both are used, imply equanimity, but they're actually two different words. So what the summum that he talked about in the previous verse and the summum that he talks about here are very closely related in meaning, but they're actually two different words. So here he's using in the sense of summum, in the sense of sameness, constancy, evenness, equanimity, imperturbability. And as I said, since he talks about the shantam, the peace, and the summum, the equanimity, immediately after talking about the practice of incessantly facing inwards, what he implies is that the more we look within, the more we will subside and thereby experience profound equanimity and peace. So that is when we read Bhagavan's verses, there's always a lot more than just the surface meaning of the words. Bhagavan implies a lot more than he states explicitly. So we have to read his verses very carefully to understand all the implication in them. Because in this particular song, Bhagavan is using the metaphor of making apalam. Since making apalam has various ingredients and has various processes one has to go through, but what Bhagavan is describing through all these things is essentially just the one practice of being firmly self-attentive. More we are firmly self-attentive, the more all the qualities that he described in the previous verse, that is, in the previous verse he spoke about satsanga. Satsanga, as Bhagavan said, the best satsanga, sat means what exists, what is real. What exists and what is real is only ourself. So the best satsanga is being self-attentive. That is the best way of associating with sat, or that is the satsanga in its deepest sense. So he spoke about satsanga. He spoke about sama, dhamma, and uparati. Sama means the tranquility or calmness of mind. Dhamma means taming, curbing, or subduing the mind by withdrawing it from external and internal objects. This is how these terms are generally described. And uparati is cessation of mental activity by giving up interest in anything other than oneself. So all these qualities, they are all achieved just by being self-attentive. So actually what Bhagavan is describing in so many ways in this song is this simple, essential practice of turning, looking within, or being self-attentive. That's what the whole song is about, but he's using all these different metaphors, but pointing at a single practice, simple practice of looking within, seeing who am I, trying to see who am I, that is being self-attentive in order to see who am I. So he uses this and the analogy of the calm and peaceful state of mind, that is the board. the firm board on which the aplomb is to be rolled, the summum, the constancy or evenness or equanimity is the rolling pin. And then he goes on to say, shantamam kuravial by the board which is peace, samamana. The rolling pin is the peace, and the samamana is the steadiness or evenness is the palahe, the plank or the board on which you are to roll it. Sorry, I was mixing up the metaphors here. So that's in the third line. He describes those two. And then in the last line, he says, santatum. Santatum means constantly. So santatum in effect means the same as in the second line of this verse. He used an adverbial participle, oyadu. Oyadu means incessantly. So what you do incessantly, you're doing always. So by using both of these adverbs, both oyadu in the first half of the verse and shantam in the second half of the verse, he is emphasizing the need for constancy. That is, we may not be able to hold on to self-attentiveness uninterruptedly, but our aim should be to hold on to self-attentiveness uninterruptedly. That means whatever else the body, speech, and mind may be doing, we should be trying deep in our heart to be holding on to self-attentiveness. Because whatever the instruments of action, mind, speech, and body, whatever actions, mind, speech, and body may be doing, we never cease to be aware I am. So we can always hold on to that self-attentiveness, even in the midst of other activities, if we have an interest to do so. So if we have a love to do so. So our aim in practice is to be, we not only need to go deeper and deeper within, our inward facing needs to be more and more constant. So that is what Bhagavan describes in the second line as oyadu, and in this fourth line as santatam. Oyadu means incessantly or without a break, and santatam means always. Yeah, santam means always, constantly, uninterruptedly, perpetually, eternally, or forever. So that is what we must be working towards, making our self-attentiveness not just 5 minutes morning and evening, and the rest of the day we allow our mind to go wherever it wants. Even in the midst of our other activities, even when we are driving our car or working in the office or cooking food in the kitchen or whatever else we may be doing, we should be trying to hold on to that self-attentiveness. Because whatever else we may be doing, we are always aware I am. So I am is always available for us to hold on to. And then he says, salipuara. Salipuara means without weariness. In this context, weariness... that is, salipu means weariness, weakness, languishing, inattentiveness, negligence, or forgetfulness. So in this context, what it implies is pramada. Pramada means self-negligence or slackness in self-attentiveness or failure to attend to ourselves. So if we become tired or we become weary trying to attend to ourselves, we allow our attention to go outwards. So we need to not allow ourselves to slacken in our firm hold on self-attentiveness. As Bhagavan describes in Nana, in the 10th paragraph of Nana, he says, sarupa dhyanate vidaha pidiyai pidikabendam. That is a very forceful way of saying to hold on to self-attentiveness tenaciously. That is the best adverb we can find in English for that is tenaciously. But in Tamil, it's it's put in a much more spirited way. Bhagavan says, Vida means without leaving. Pidi is an adverb formed from the word pidi, which means to hold. And pidika means to hold. So unleavingly, holdingly, holding. It would be a very literal translation of it, but it's a very forceful way of saying holding on to it so tenaciously, but we don't let go of it. That is what is required. Likewise, in verse 17 of Upadesha Undia, for example, he says, Manatin Uruve Maravadu Chaba, when one investigates the form of an nature of the mind, that is, when we investigate that fundamental awareness, I am, is the implication there, because that's a true form of the mind. What he described in the previous verse as manum tan oli uru, the mind's own form of light, that is the true form of the mind. So that manatin uruve means holding on to that fundamental awareness, I am. And he uses an adverbial participle there, maravadu. Maravadu means without forgetting or without neglecting. So again, it implies without pramado. So we should be so keenly self-attentive, but we don't allow ourselves to fall a prey to pramada, fall a prey to negligence. We need to hold on to ourselves so intensely. So that is what he implies here by salipuara, without weariness, without languishing, without weakness, without inattentiveness. And finally, he says, the final word, is, I think that's the final one, santosha mahave, yes. Santosha mahave means joyfully, happily. That is, the more we look within, the more the mind will subside, and thereby we experience the equanimity and the peace. And we also experience joy, because what is our real nature? Our real nature is infinite joy. So the more we look within and thereby subside back into the heart, the more we will experience that profound inner joy that is always shining in our heart as I am. So very, very importantly, he ends this verse with this adverb, santosha mahabe, joyfully, happily. That is, if we are truly following Bhagavan's path correctly, even if we haven't yet reached the point where we are willing to surrender ourselves completely, to the extent to which we surrender ourselves by looking within, to that extent, our life will be pleasant and peaceful and joyful. That is, all agitation arises because we allow our attention to move away from ourselves. This is why in the 13th paragraph of Nana, in the paragraph where Bhagavan talks about surrender, he first describes surrender as holding on to self-attentiveness so firmly, but we thereby do not give the slightest room to the rising of any thought other of oneself. In other words, we are so keenly self-attentive, but no other thought can arise. That is giving ourselves to God, he says. And then he says in the next sentence, however much burden we place on God, he will bear all of it. What he implies by that is we need not be concerned about anything else. Our only responsibility is to hold firmly to self-attentiveness and thereby give ourselves entirely to God. If we do so, he will take care of everything. Then in the next sentence of that 13th paragraph, he says, when that one Parameshwara Shakti, that one Parameshwara Shakti refers to God. Shakti means power. Ishwara means God, or it also means ruler, the ruling power. Parameshwara, that supreme ruling power, or the power of God. When that one power that is God, that is our own real nature, is driving all karyas. Karyas means whatever needs to happen, whatever ought to happen, whatever needs to be done, whatever ought to be done. Everything is happening, is being driven by him. When such is the case, Bhagavan says, why should we, instead of yielding ourselves to that, be constantly thinking, I need to do this, I need to do that? Or he doesn't even say, I need to do this. It's necessary to do this, it's necessary to do that. That is, there's nothing we need do other than just holding on to self-attentiveness, other than incessantly looking within. Oyadu ulmukum, facing within, looking deep in our heart incessantly. That is the only responsibility Bhagavan has given us. As he said, when someone asked something about duty, Bhagavan said, your duty is not to be this or that. Your duty is just to be. How can we just be? Only by holding on to self-attentiveness. So that's the only responsibility Bhagavan has given us. If we hold on to self-attentiveness, he will take care of everything else. He has given us that very clear assurance there. And then he says, he then uses the analogy of a passenger traveling on a train. When we're traveling on a train, we know the train is carrying all the burden. So why should we continue carrying our small burden on our head? Why should we carry our luggage on our head? Since the train, whether we put the luggage on our head or on the seat beside us, the train is carrying the luggage, and the luggage is going to reach its destination because the train will take it there. So we don't have to be concerned about anything else. We don't have to take on the burden of anything. We can leave the entire burden of our entire life and all our loved ones, everything he is taking care of. So leave everything to him. Our only aim is to hold firmly to self-attentiveness, to look within. And he says there, he says, why to suffer? In kashtaparavendam, why do you suffer by carrying it on your head instead of sukhamai, instead of happily, joyfully traveling at ease by putting it aside? So if we are following Bhagavan's path of self-investigation and self-surrender correctly, this is a very joyful path. Because we leave the entire burden, all our cares, all our concerns, all our worries, we leave entirely to Bhagavan's care. Our only aim is to be happily, peacefully surrendered to him by holding on to I am. That's all that is required. And surrendering to him is so easy, because all we have to do to surrender ourselves is to hold on to I am. The more we hold on to I am, the more ego will thereby subside. That is, the surrender will happen effortlessly, merely by virtue of our being firmly self-attentive, by our incessantly facing within. This is everything. That is why Bhagavan Bhagavan diagnosed what is the root cause of all our problems. What is the root cause of our illness? It is nothing but ego. And since he diagnosed one ultimate cause for all our problems, he prescribed one simple medicine. That simple medicine, what is ego? It's a false awareness, I am this body. So long as we look outwards, we're aware of ourselves as I am this body. So what is the solution? Stop looking outward, look within, hold on to I am alone, and the body will drop off. Everything will drop off if we hold on to I am. Why? Because the body is not holding on to us. We are holding on to the body, saying, I am this body. We can't blame the body for that. So if we hold on, instead of holding on to the body and consequently being aware of ourselves as I am this body, if we hold on to I am, we become more and more clearly aware of ourselves as I am just I. And the more clearly we are aware of ourselves as I alone, the more joyful and more peaceful, calm, and joyful our life will be. So that is what Bhagavan is describing so beautifully in this verse. The key word in this verse is in the first line, ulmukam, facing within. Facing within how? As I am I. That is, facing in within to see ourselves as ourself alone, to see nothing but ourself. The more we look within, the more ego and mind will subside, the more we will thereby experience shantam, samam, and santosham. We'll experience the peace, the equanimity, and the supreme joy. And what is that supreme joy? That is Ramana. The very name Ramana means joy, or the giver of joy. So he has come to give us joy. He is ever ready to give us joy, but he just we need to be willing to accept the joy he's waiting to give us. How can we accept it? Only by holding on to I Am. Because I Am itself is that joy, but is Ramana. Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Arunachala Ramanaya.